HP Enterprise brings high-end SDS to SMBs. Pulseway enters the ComboArm MPSA market, Cisco restructuring, data-driven automation, Windows Mobile's last stand, and more. Channel Pro Weekly, Episode 22, Swift Justice. Welcome to Channel 4 Weekly, Episode 22. My name is Matt Whitlock, technology editor and slow podcast editor for Channel 4 Weekly. Joining me this week and most weeks, except for last week because we didn't do a show because, you know, Rich decided to take some time off, which he's not really supposed to do. But
I thought that was in his contract. He's not supposed to take time off.
Didn't we determine that he's a robot? And that he needs...
Oh, right.
Right. Oh, we just had to plug him in. So, like, what does a robot need vacation for?
I'm getting really glad that I never read my contract.
Just sign
what,
it.
What else is buried in there?
What else could go wrong?
That you're a robot.
Well, let's see. That friendly voice there is Miss Cecilia Galvin, the editor-in-chief and channel queen and one who keeps the trains moving on time here.
Hey, everybody. Do you see me doing my pageantry wave?
not via audio, but we'll just have to close our eyes and put the vision in our heads. The robot who went on vacation is senior news editor and well-rested Rich Freeman.
And for a robot, I spent a week drinking a whole lot of wine.
Is that one of the things? Do you have like organic batteries that need to be recharged?
Apparently with a good cab. Yep.
Oh, fabulous.
So I know what I did while you were on vacation, which I'll get to in a minute. But Rich, why don't you tell us about your vacation?
Oh, well, I would be happy to, actually. So I have this group of friends that I've been getting together with every August decades at this point. I met most of these people in college, and just every August we get together, and as the years have gone by, people have gotten married, they've had kids. You know, there are kids who come to this gathering now who are either in or about to go to college. I mean, this has just been going on forever. And well, I don't know, for about the last 6 to 8 years, let's say, we've been gathering in wine country near San Francisco. It happens to be convenient for a sort of critical mass of people, and so we rented a house in the Russian River Valley and did some wine tasting and some paddling and some hanging out, and it was a great time.
So if this started in college, have you noticed that, like, an evolution, not of just, like, life, but of the things that you drink when you guys get together? Like, did you start on, like, really cheap, crappy beer in college and then kind of seen tastes get refined over the years?
Yeah, pretty much. That would be one thing that's changed. Not that I've thought about this, but you're absolutely right. So started out with cheap beer, then it became cheap wine, then nicer wine. And then the other thing that's probably changed a bunch over the years is the quality of the food, basically, which has gotten better and better, both because we can actually afford better groceries, but also because we've just gotten pickier about what we cook for one another and so on.
Well, that's cool. I think probably the next evolution is to get into, like, you know, the fine bourbons and move to the hard stuff, so that way you can't even remember getting together by the time you get back.
And then you do it again. It's like, yeah, we should do that.
That sounds kind of fun to have a long time tradition like that.
It is. It's a big milestone in the year for me, so I always look forward to it.
So you were in wine country the whole time?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Favorite winery you went to?
Let's see. I would say, and this is more about the setting than the wine necessarily, but there's a place called the Russian River Winery, which has very good, not spectacular, but very good wine. But they also have this sort of outside courtyard area, basically, where they will let you take a table, and you can do a tasting at the table, and they also serve food. So, you know, we ordered some, like a cheese platter, and we were doing a wine tasting, and the weather was warm but gorgeous, and we were just hanging out on a, whatever it was, Saturday afternoon, and that was pretty nice. I would recommend that to anybody.
That sounds awesome. Cecilia, how did you celebrate Rich's vacation?
I celebrated Rich's vacation by working overtime.
Oh, no.
Well, that,
tell me I'm not to blame for that.
You share part of the blame, I would say.
I probably share more of the blame, as usual.
It was fine. Just wait until I go on vacation for 2 months. Just wait.
Oh, my gosh. We will literally fall apart. Like, I'll just go sit over there in the corner in a fetal position, rocking back and forth.
That's sweet.
I decided to celebrate Rich's vacation by going out and playing a friendly game of softball in our little local neighborhood, organized adult 16-inch softball game in which I proceeded to nearly break my ankle.
Mm. Oof.
Running to and stepping on awkwardly on one of the bases. So for the last week and a half or so, I've been hobbling around on crutches. Very embarrassing.
Hang up the cleats, man. Hang up the cleats.
You know, I think it's just God telling me that I was not intended to do any more physical activity, that I should now just stay indoors in front of the computer screen and be ultra lazy. So.
I like it.
Yeah.
It works for me.
Yeah. I got to join Rich's group and just drink instead.
Yep.
Which helps. But it is getting better, thankfully. I'm starting to walk on it a little bit now, but of course, you know, as long as I don't smack it into anything too hard, it doesn't hurt all that bad.
But, well, watch out, because our boss is going to fly out to the Chicago area and twist your other ankle. It's a great thing for Channel Pro to have you stuck in front of a computer all day.
Yeah, need to do even more of that, too. So to at least... mention to our wonderful listeners who have been very patient. I am currently the one who is kind of putting a lot of this together and doing the recording and then doing all the editing, which I hope to offload to somebody in the future. So I do apologize. I try to be as regular as possible getting these shows out, but I know the last few weeks have been really crazy and I'm a few episodes behind getting the shows out. So everybody, I will take the blame and try to rush getting what has been kind of not edited and out on the site out to you guys as soon as possible. So hang in there with me. And I know it's supposed to be weekly, but sometimes it'll be a little more than a week. Sometimes, you know, I'll try to go as fast as possible. And it shouldn't shock anyone, as if anybody knows, everybody knows that getting things like my copy to Cecilia for the magazine on time is also a challenge. So this should not come as a shocker to people that I get a little slammed and have to scramble sometimes to get things done. So
he's a man with too much on his plate.
Boy, ain't that no joke. So a couple of other little exciting things before we kind of dive into the news here, but we are getting prepared now, barreling full steam ahead towards our next live event. We haven't really done any over the summer. I think our last one was like in May. But we do have the next one coming up. So, Cecilia, you want to tell people where that's at and if they want to go, what they can do?
Well, the next event is September 14th with a pre-day event that is hosted by Logic Now on the 13th. And then there's a cocktail reception on the evening of the 13th, and the full day program that is a really great business building program that any Channel Pro at just about any stage of on the development and growth continuum will find useful information. This one is in the Washington, D.C. area. The exact town is, help me, Rich.
Well, officially it's Herndon, Virginia, but we will be at the Westin Washington Dulles, so we will be okay. Near Dulles Airport outside D.C.
Okay,
yeah,
perfect.
It's right by the airport, practically on the airport. So if right. You know where Dulles is, that's where the hotel is.
And it's got, you know, we have a lot of giveaways. We have a lot of vendors do giveaways. We have an awesome, what we call the Petting Zoo, which is a hardware session that Matt runs, where you can get up close and personal with all different kinds of hardware. And it's a really interesting, informative, and enjoyable event. So I highly recommend it.
Yeah, it's a fun time. So, yeah, if you're going to be in the rough D.C. area in the middle of September, please make it a point to pop out and visit us and learn a little bit, because there's lots of good stuff in there to learn.
And the website, Matt?
Yeah, there you go. I was just going to do that.
Anyone?
Oh, yeah. So if you want to learn more about that and get the link to register, it's events.channelpronetwork.com. Or if you got our main site bookmarked, which you should, there's a events link on our main site, channelpronetwork.com. Just hit that and it'll take you there, and you'll be able to see where to go from there. It's pretty straightforward. All right. So let's dive in. Since we're kind of a couple weeks behind on shows here, because Rich was gone. We've got some stuff to cover, so I think we're going to pop through some of these news stories that we wanted to go get through, hopefully in kind of a more rapid fire format. But Rich, why don't you kick us off with what HP's up to in the storage space?
Yeah, well, kind of a big headline this week. Not been a hugely active news week. Here we are in August, vacation season, and so on. But on Monday, if I remember right, HPE announced some new software-defined storage products that are specifically targeted at the SMB space, and they're kind of noteworthy because they sort of break the $10,000 barrier for these kinds of software-defined storage systems. And I say that with a little hesitation because I'm not so familiar with the SDS market that I can say nobody else has crossed that line before. But for a company like HPE, a very serious storage vendor, obviously, to take some existing product lines that have really been enterprise-oriented and bring them down market, get the price tag under five digits so that SMBs can afford it, I thought was pretty interesting stuff, and kind of a landmark moment in the spread or evolution of software-defined storage. So it'll be interesting to see basically what kind of difference these new products make in terms of SDS adoption within SMBs, what HPE competitors maybe do to sort of keep pace. Does HPE itself add more software and hardware for SMBs around software-defined storage, et cetera? So interesting development, and we'll see if it triggers some other ones.
Yeah, it's a cool announcement, and you hit it exactly right. This is just starting to bring a lot more of the high end tech that you normally find in enterprise SDS down market. So you can get something with 64-bit ARM, RAID stack with thin provisioning, replication, and a dual controller array as low as $6,000. So it's pretty cool stuff. And I think this will be if you're doing a lot with software defined networking or software defined storage, too much software defined stuff these days.
Yeah.
This should be exciting. I don't want to say they're completely alone. I think you're going to start to see if we haven't already. I think Dell's going to come in and start competing neck and neck with them and lots of the other big SDS guys. But HP's definitely bringing it down market and giving some more exciting products for the SMB space. You gonna get one of them SDS units for your home office?
Yeah. Oh my gosh, it's like a drop in the bucket. No.
Well, I know you need some thin provisioning replication and data snapshots and all that stuff.
Oh sure.
Yeah, I know you like granular recovery. That's another one.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. It's all about the granular recovery. So, Rich, there's some more stuff happening with the RMM PSA market with a company. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that one?
Yeah, well, that's another story that I put up on the website this week. Just as a little context, I suspect that one of the reasons I'm responsible for Celia working overtime, and I'm racked with guilt about that still, is because I was a bit tardy in getting her copy for the what will be the cover story in our September issue, which is about some really interesting stuff that's been happening over the course of the last year or so in the RMM market. And we'll talk about that in a future show. But, I mean, I've been working on that recently, and so it just kind of has me thinking about and paying close attention to the RMM space and new solutions from existing vendors and new solutions from newer vendors. So this week, a company that I am going to guess most of the people listening now have never heard of, called Pulseway, introduced an MSP-targeted version of its RMM system. So Pulseway has had an RMM product on the market since 2011. And really, I mean, they sort of emphasize that they're a mobile-first, cloud-first kind of company, and that's really where they got started, is the guy who coded this application did it because he wanted to be able to monitor servers and take remedial action and so on from his iPhone, and he couldn't find anything that would let him do that exactly the way he wanted to, and so he created this mobile-first platform and eventually released it through the App Store and got a response to it. So, I mean, you know, for the last 5 years, basically, the product has been out there. He hasn't really had, or the company hasn't really had, a version of the system that is specifically oriented towards MSPs in terms of how you pay for it and some of the functionality MSPs need. So that's what got rolled out this week. And there are a number of you know, interesting, notable things about this product, Pulseway MSP, as it's officially known. But I guess what the one that stands out is just that it includes a PSA module. And this is one of those trends that we've been seeing over the course of the last 12 months or so. You know, Autotask did this. Another sort of newer RMM company called Atera did this, where the RMM product actually comes with its own PSA functionality. It, in the case of Pulseway and these other companies, the RMM system integrates with other PSA, third-party PSA products, too, if you want to do that. But you don't have to if you want to go ahead and use the manufacturer's PSA system. So it's one of those, or one of several trends, basically, that we're kind of seeing in the RMM space right now. And we'll have more to discuss on that front in a few weeks when the September issue starts showing up in people's mailbox.
All right, so I have a question.
Yes.
So before they developed Pulseway MSP, they had the RMM product, and it was not specifically targeted to managed service providers. So what was their market? Was it businesses with a IT presence or in the business kind of thing?
I think it's fair to say that the market that the company had in mind when it first put the product out, well, you know, so, and I keep referring vaguely to this guy who's responsible for the system. His name is Marius Mihalic. I hope I'm pronouncing it correct. He was he was actually a coder. He was a developer for a company in Ireland, but he had some responsibility for that company's infrastructure. And so he had administrative duties about that, and that's why he wanted a system that would let him remotely monitor. And he had other people like himself in mind, basically, when he created the product. You know, IT professionals working at SMBs, who had to do or were paid to do infrastructure management and needed a way to do that, you know, anytime, anywhere, basically.
Okay. And the name of the company?
Pulseway. Oh, I'm sorry, the company, the product
yeah, the company.
Is Pulseway. The company is MMSoft Design Limited.
Okay. Just in case anybody wanted to go look that up.
Yeah, well, the website actually is Pulseway.com.
Pulseway MSP? Oh, really?
Yeah,
okay.
But officially the company responsible for the product is MMSoft Design Limited.
I'm wondering about that MM is the guy's initials.
I have a hunch.
Better he just really likes small chocolate candies.
Right. With coating that doesn't melt in your hands? That one?
That's the one. Pulseway, melt in your hand, not in your mouth.
So it'll be interesting to find out as time rolls by what the RMM and PSA markets combined will look like, you know, 18 months from now, because this pace of development, all of these innovations and new features, enhancements, APIs in the RMM space, it's fascinating. Fascinating. It's like a different market than it was just a couple years ago.
Definitely. Definitely. And as the article that I sent you will point out, that's being driven by larger trends in managed services right now that are being reflected in RMM. And what's interesting to me, when you talk to MSPs about vendors either selling both an RMM and a PSA product, you know, independently, or actually combining those into one solution and selling them as a bundle, I think it makes a lot of MSPs nervous, basically, because if you like Company A's RMM system and Company B's PSA system, you really want to have the flexibility and the freedom to continue using those two things and have them integrate with one another. And the manufacturers on both the RMM and the PSA side say, oh, yeah, that's not going to change. We're not going to change. We're still going to integrate with everybody. We just happen to have our own PSA system now, too. But there's anxiety out there about whether that's going to remain sort of permanently true, because if you're in the RMM market, you have basically every incentive to give your customers reasons to use your PSA product and not some other company's PSA product. And so, you know, does that begin to get reflected in certain ways, you know, in terms of what is or isn't supported on, you know, your own PSA product versus some competitor's PSA product? Only time will tell. The manufacturers say, don't worry about it.
Yeah,
the MSPs are a little nervous, and we'll.
I thought it was maybe too many eggs in one basket for MSPs, like that feeling like, oh, well, wait a minute.
Sure. Yeah, no, that comes up in conversation a lot, too. Exactly.
Well, if you get a lot of eggs in one basket, you know. If you get a lot of eggs in one basket, you got to make omelets.
Yeah.
That's the way it is. Mix it all together, RMM, PSA, it's all got to come together, right?
It's just the way it is.
Yeah, so speaking of things coming together or flying apart, Cisco has got some craziness going on there.
Yeah, did this remind anyone else of the announcement from Intel back in, what was it, March, I think?
Yep.
It's just spot on. You know, you could almost take the text from Cisco.
They copied the news release.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, right. So, you know, basically, as I'm guessing a lot of our listeners are aware, Cisco reported their, I believe, fourth quarter financials yesterday. That would be August 17th. Revenue was up, profit was up, not enormously, but, you know, so they're doing okay. But they also announced in the course of that they will be eliminating 5,500 positions, about 7% of the workforce going forward. And they are doing so because, like so many other very big, well-established vendors in the IT world, they are shifting into new markets. And Intel made a very similar announcement back in March that we've spoken about before. You know, it's basically almost exactly the same markets that Cisco is building its future around, and there's nothing terribly surprising about that. Cloud computing, IoT, data center computing. So, you know, same thinking, same strategy, same needs, and same somewhat inevitable but unfortunate result for thousands of IT workers out there who are going to see their positions either eliminated or, not replaced, not refilled when they retire or something
right.
like that.
You know, this was also a local story for me. I am based in the Chapel Hill area of North Carolina, and Cisco Systems is not very far from here in the Research Triangle Park, which is, if anyone's not familiar with that, it's a big research campus with many, many, pedigreed vendors, Cisco being one of them. They have one of the biggest campuses there, in fact. And this made the news that they were cutting jobs again. And it was like, you know, the world is coming to an end because they've cut so many jobs from this area already. You know, in a previous wave, what was that, 2014? It wasn't that long ago. So I was like, what? And then I saw your story, and I was like, big news.
Well, if they're cutting positions, that's one thing. But you said that they're moving into all of these new markets. I mean, are some of those people going to just be, you know, laid off, but then kind of like rehired into new positions? Or is this just across the board, 5,500 jobs gone?
Well, it's not from here for sure. I mean, Cisco's all over the world, so it's hard to say.
I personally have not seen, I don't know if Cisco has shared specifics about this. I personally have not seen any specifics in terms of where those 5,500 people are coming from within the organization. But
I haven't either.
I would imagine, if you're helping them manufacture switching hardware or something like that, if your skill set is really tied to one of the legacy businesses that's going to be less important for them going forward, then, you know, you're probably closer to the chopping block.
Interestingly enough, I told you I went looking for that kind of information, and I came across the careers at Cisco, and of course they're local. They've got a lot of positions available. So go figure. I guess in the newer areas.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, like I said, it's a profitable business. It's not like they're contracting. They're just
reallocating.
Yeah.
So do you foresee, Rich, some kind of clash of the Titans between Intel and Cisco? I wouldn't generally say they compete, but they haven't traditionally and always like in the same markets. So are we going to see more clash between those two, you think? Or do you think that they're going to each find their niches in those categories?
I mean, I would think for the most part they find their niches. It's in, when you think about a market like IoT, in a way, we're still kind of watching the IoT strategy evolve at both companies. You could imagine that they might collide there, depending on where they decide their competency is, their opportunity is. This is not something I've researched, but
IoT is so broad that.
Just imagine, because one of the things that really still needs to happen before IoT, absolutely achieves blastoff is standards need to become more widely adopted. So, I mean, what if Cisco and Intel, and this is maybe a crazy idea, like I said, I haven't researched this, but what if they both get behind different standards? That would be a scenario where the Clash of the Titans thing, winds up coming to life.
I like it.
Ooh, fingers juicy crossed. News to write about. Well, that'll be fun to watch, I guess. Cool. So, Cecilia, you've got a story on this list here. Before we go to that, maybe we should take a quick break.
Okay.
We've had a lot of Rich. I think we all need to.
We need to take a break from Rich.
Listen to that 5-second little jingle.
That's because we're just still mad about his vacation.
Yeah.
Dare you. All right. Coming up, we've got data-driven automation, Google doing some weird, invasive googly things that they do, and we talk about an article that ran in our print edition that we don't think we talked about in the past, at least not since it came out online, anyway. So we're going to just kind of briefly talk about that that and more. So stick around for that. We'll be right back. All right. And we are back. And Cecilia, you have got a story up about the value of data-driven automation. Now, you don't mean like driving it in a car, though, right? You mean like, because you're not going to like load up data tapes into a car and drive them places?
That would be funny. No, this story is based on a survey that LogicNow did, which is, I have to say, now part of SolarWinds MSP. And they did a survey report, and of course it's called The Value of Data-Driven Automation to the ITSM, IT Service Management market, industry, whatever. So, of course, I'm getting all confused now. So I'll just take a deep breath. All right.
It's okay. Whenever I think about LogicNow, I get
you get confused. It's the logic cards, maybe.
It's the logic GFI Max Solar Wind Power.
Yes.
Now.
Yes.
Company. Those guys.
Exactly. So, essentially, what they found from the survey, the kind of early takeaway is that the IT business is very different now. Instead of just providing services and whatever, customers are now looking for like managed service providers to know about the technology trends, make sure that they're protected from threats, they have no downtime, and they want to have more value through the services that the proactive services that the managed service providers offer to them. So they did this survey and they wanted to know, because there is so much now on MSP's plates, and they wanted to know if MSPs were using the data that is that their customers, oh my God, it's like somebody put bubble gum in my mouth. Help me, Rich. Okay, go.
Here we go. And I should say, it was not a huge surprise to me. I saw the headline for this story and was interested and clicked through to read it, and it was not a giant surprise to me when I saw that this was about a study from LogicNow, because they are really the leaders right now in data-driven automation.
Yes.
We're about 11, 12 months away from the introduction of logic cards,
right?
Which is this system that they came out with, basically, that studies past performance data from managed endpoints and uses it basically to predict the future. So it's they're sort of data mining all of this performance data from workstations and servers, and uncovering patterns in terms of what tends to happen before a server fails, for example, or whatever. And then they can alert an MSP when that pattern is developing. Hey, based on what we've seen before, that server one of your customers is running could be headed for a failure. And as the MSP, you can go off and fix it before that problem develops and there's downtime and so on. So I was absolutely fascinated when this technology was introduced. I expected to see a lot more other systems like it. That hasn't really happened a whole bunch. And I mean, we could talk about why, but basically, I think what LogicNow is kind of talking about in this study or doing is calling attention to the fact that there is this giant resource out there, the immense amounts of information that can be mined to better understand, better serve your clients, and specifically automate support processes. So, I mean, in terms of where LogicNow is headed right now, they're not here yet, but where they're going is that they want not only to be able to alert an MSP that, hey, that server over there might be about to fail, they actually want to be able to automate the corrective action so that, you as the MSP will probably get notification, but you don't necessarily need to do anything. Their software will both identify the potential problem and know, based on your past actions or your instructions, what to do about it and do it for you. So that's why they would be publishing a story about data-driven automation. It's very strategic for them.
Right. But unfortunately, not a lot of MSPs are doing this. Out of the survey participants, only 54% are collecting and storing their clients' IT performance data. And then of that 54%, 81% of that group, they're using it to improve the services that they provide, which is great, but it's not quite where Logic Now is headed. And they said that in this survey, only 8% of all respondents have developed any automated processes that would give them actionable recommendations.
So, you know, just an immense growth opportunity, you know,
yes,
for Logic Now, but really for the whole managed services space.
Right.
Doesn't this bring up some interesting existential questions, though? Like, for example, if you get alerted that a server is about to fail and you fix it, did you actually fix it? Or because it never actually failed? This is like precognition kind of stuff. This is kind of making me uncomfortable. How do you define, like, was it actually ever destined to fail if you prevent it from happening in the first place?
It's a fine question.
But it doesn't matter as long as the customer does not experience any downtime or ill effects from whatever action you took or the automated systems took. Doesn't matter.
We do need more automated systems doing our job for us. I can say that for sure.
Yep.
You especially.
Yeah.
Sorry, that didn't come out right.
Well, you're fired. We're going to replace you with an automated system. That is really, really cool stuff. They're not completely alone in that, though, right? I mean, isn't that a lot of the kind of stuff that, like, Microsoft is doing with Azure and predictive analytics and that kind of ties in with IoT and, you know, all of that, like, predicting failure and that kind of thing. I mean, so, like, they're not completely alone in this, right?
No, but the predicting part is just the predicting part. The automation part is going a step further and taking corrective action without needing a human to do it. So that, to Logic Now's point, will enable MSPs to broaden their client base and provide additional services that their customers are now looking for, because a lot of things can happen behind the scenes to keep things running.
Maybe that's the part
that I thought was awesome.
Yeah, maybe that's the part that I'm not following 100%. Like, what is the automated part? Like, I mean, if a server is about to fail, I don't see how a piece of software can go and, like, fix a server. So, like, where is the automation part?
Well, it may not be a server. It could be some other, you know, glitch somewhere within the system.
So, Rich, is the automation just in the case that was the example that you guys used? So I'm trying to wrap my head around like what this.
Yep.
So in the case of a glitch in a server or predicting the software is predicting a server is going to fail. It's just the automation part, like automatically putting out a business process in front of somebody to go and fix it, or is this actually taking action in other types of situations? Like, is it deploying AV software? What is it doing?
And I'm trying to come up with a great example, and I'm sure if we had an actual MSP speaking here, they could do it. But, I mean, just imagine a scenario where you have a server that has failed or is about to fail, and there are five steps that you at your company always kind of perform in that situation. And it's like, okay, we're going to take the virtual machines, you know, we'll take a snapshot of the machine, we'll migrate the virtual machines onto a different server, you know, we'll power the server down, and then, yeah, the next day, if this is some on-premises piece of equipment, somebody goes out and fixes it, or if it's a cloud-based thing, we spawn some new virtual server. But if you have a standard way of dealing with this particular technical issue, theoretically, your RMM software could kind of begin to learn that, begin to see that after a while. And then it could sort of ask for permission to just do that for you so that you don't actually have to go and execute this standard operating procedure, how to respond to this particular kind of technical issue. The software knows how you respond to this issue because it's seen you do it, and it just does the parts that it can do for you automatically on your behalf. Again, if there's on-premises hardware involved, so far at least, the RMM companies can't dispatch the Terminator to go out and fix it for you or whatever. But anything that can happen sort of in the virtual world could theoretically just be done for you automatically.
Not so much as virtualized these days. But isn't it crazy that you use the words "what the software sees you do stuff"? Isn't that kind of freaky? Like, it's watching. It knows what you do.
It is watching you. Yeah. I imagine there are people who get a little uncomfortable about that. It's watching you, and it's storing information about everything you do, and it's pooling it together with information about everything everybody else does, basically. And that's what makes its knowledge, its predictive capabilities powerful. But it is a little creepy, just a little bit.
It's creepy and cool all at the same time.
Exactly.
Oh, our robot overlords. It's coming. As Rich and I both agree, someday we'll be bowing down to machines. So speaking of one of the companies that's going to get us to bowing down to machines, Google is doing what they always do and starting to dabble in a new market to play around. And anytime Google dabbles in a new market, generally one of two things happen. Either nothing happens and they kind of get bored and stop dabbling in said market, or they end up kind of taking it over and having a gigantic impact on everything. So in this story, Google is getting into processors. So Rich, do you want to kind of introduce this one, or do you want me to kind of talk about it?
Yeah, why don't you go for it, actually? This is your bailiwick.
So so Google, it wants to build a rival to Intel's processors. But it wouldn't be x86, so I don't know how much of a rival that's actually going to be. But there, Google has, like driverless cars and all these other things. So Google would naturally have to purchase, processing to power all of their efforts. And why do that when they have the wherewithal internally to take it all in house and build it themselves? So, I don't know how well this is going to work out for them. I think that they'll probably succeed in designing, kind of like what Apple does, like designing some of their own processors and having them fabricated. But I don't know if I see this going far out of their own internal use. Who knows? Maybe it would. That's kind of the introduction. What do you think, Rich?
The first thing I'll say is this is why I kind of like Google, is because every now and again you read some story about something they're doing that just makes you go, huh? What? Google's making processors? I can't think of any other company in the IT industry that more often kind of confounds expectations than those guys. Two possibilities come to mind, and this is one yet another of those situations where you have to speculate a little bit about what they're doing and why they're doing it. And one possibility is it's one of those things where they don't feel like the industry is innovating as rapidly or in the way that they would like it to, and so they're going to kind of do some things themselves and see if they can inspire or force everybody else to kind of follow along. Because I don't think, for example, that they ever aspire to totally dominate broadband, for example, but they're doing some really interesting stuff in broadband delivery, and probably they're kind of looking to get an industry moving there. Maybe that's what's going on here. I don't know. The other thing that comes to mind is just that they've been building their own servers for years and years. I mean, the servers in their data centers are their own sort of in-house custom recipe, And maybe it has to do with that, basically, that, you know, it will either be more cost effective to create their own processors, or that, you know, they can't get processors that do what they need processors to do. And so this isn't something that will affect system builders. It's really more about Google itself. Those are the two sort of possibilities that spring to mind.
So I have to imagine that Google's need for processing does differ from your traditional server processor, maybe because of it's the scale or the types of operations that they're doing. I could certainly see that. And I there's just so many angles to think about this from. Anyone who has gone up against Intel, with the exception of ARM and mobile, and that's not because of, like, one company is going up against them. It's kind of like a whole batch of companies. But anyone who's tried to dominate try to go against Intel where they really are dominant, generally does not make it. I mean, AMD has been going at them now for 20 years, and they had some success at one point and then just got completely crushed. So I will say, competition is good, right? I'm a big believer in competition. So if Google entering this market is enough to, you know, prod Intel to improve their products and to, you know, spur competition and make better products for all, I think that's great. I just don't know if Google is, I just don't see Google doing it. And then, of course, you know, like they're doing healthcare and driverless cars and they're doing all this stuff. And the one thing that you said that I totally disagree with is I don't think Google enters any market looking to do anything other than completely end up dominating it over time. They are the kings, and I say this over and over again, they are the kings of doing something small, but then iterating and iterating and iterating at this really rapid pace. You know, innovation by iteration, and you know, they did it in search, they did it in mobile, they did it in, they're doing it in driverless cars. I think I have a feeling that they are going to be so far ahead of everybody in terms of automated cars that it's going to be just insane. And with AMD kind of taking kind of a backward, like there's nobody really pressuring Intel at this high end anymore, so. They may have a chance. I don't know. It's just completely crazy.
Yet another reason to scratch our heads over Google.
Cecilia, do you think Google's got a chance in processing?
I think Google can do pretty much whatever Google wants, and I mean, it's done it before where it's made, you know, manufactured things for its own use, like you were talking about the servers. And the company may very well just create processors for its own use. And as one of the analysts that was interviewed for the story said that, you know, that could put enough pressure on Intel to either make some changes or reduce its prices, whatever it is. I mean, Google has a lot of sway.
Yeah, it was actually pricing. I think that's why Google ended up, they ended up doing their own network switches, right?
At some point? Yep.
Yeah, like they brought all that in and they designed and like at the US manufactured their own networking equipment, probably because they got tired of paying companies like Cisco and whatever to do it for them, because they probably just need them at such high volume that it might make sense. But designing and getting and manufacturing a processor is a whole different animal, that I don't know how much experience Google has in house in doing that, but I mean, not very many companies fabricate processors for one, and, very few companies do their own actual processor designs. So this is an uphill, battle for Google.
Well, that's kind of what the system builders who we spoke to, they don't seem very concerned at all. That, you know, they feel that Intel's still the best bet here.
Yeah. So, you know what else Google has no concern at all over?
Uh-oh, here it comes.
Here it comes.
they don't have any concern over Windows Mobile at all. So the last thing we're going to talk about here before we hit into our end of the show notes is we've been talking a little bit about Windows Mobile over the last few shows, and it kind of inspired me to actually finally like kind of put together, I don't want to say an autopsy of Windows Mobile, because I do think that's coming at some point, but to kind of take a look at this last stand for Windows Mobile. And we might have been talking a little bit about this here and there on past shows, so I apologize if you've kind of heard some of this already, but there is an article that got published in our last issue that was called Windows Mobile's Last Stand, and what it talks about is kind of what Microsoft is kind of doing to reset again in mobile and move forward with their play for mobile, and that was all around business. So I kind of introduced this article talking about Windows Mobile as a drug, because it is kind of a drug. I'm a big Windows Phone fan. I always have been. I love how it works. So I talk a little bit about how I kind of got in there, and then I kind of how I ended up kind of becoming a Windows Mobile user, and then I said, like, now, you know, with basically Microsoft taking over Nokia and essentially like killing all of their consumer effort, it seems, for Windows phones, it's like I'm addicted to a drug that is so niche like nobody makes it anymore. So it's kind of fun wording, but in a sense, this is the last stand for Windows Mobile, and this last stand is doing what Microsoft, the only thing they can do, which is look to focus on productivity and business, to see what they can salvage out of this platform, while they look for that next big thing. So, I'll pause there. Rich, is there any comments on that so far before we kind of dive into what the last stand really is?
Well, see, now when you set it up like that, maybe I'll kind of wait and let you introduce that last stand concept there, and then maybe we can chat a little bit.
I was wondering if you were going to talk about some of your history with Windows Phone, because I know you were a Windows Phone user when I first met you.
I was for a long time, and I probably said this before on the podcast. I still believe the Windows Phone interface is hands down the best one out there. This I guess is yet another, the fate of Windows Phone to date is yet another one of those illustrations of the fact that interface doesn't win markets, you know, at the end of the day, right? I mean, the very first Apple Macintosh computers had a better interface, arguably, than, I mean, you know, there really wasn't a Windows for the first Apple Macintosh to compete with. Apple led in interface back in the early days of the PC market, but they had the interface, and Windows had the applications and the network effect, and Windows won. And now it's, you know, turnabout is fair play in mobile. I think Microsoft has done a better job than Apple in terms of interface. I continue to be surprised at how sort of antiquated, in a way, the iOS interface kind of remains at this point. But the apps are there, you know, for iOS and for Android, and that's ultimately what really matters to folks. And so,
yeah. Well, know. I mean, Android followed the Microsoft Rise model, you know, Microsoft Desktop Operating System Rise model, and went, you know, Wild West and licensed it for basically little to no cost. And, you know, I mean, Google did what Microsoft did back in the day, basically. And Microsoft tried to find a kind of a balance between the Wild West of Android and the lockdown single hardware supplier of Apple to find, like, that middle niche, which just didn't really work. But that's all autopsy. But let's talk about kind of what they're doing with it. So the play in productivity and business now is with a new product that's kind of coming out, is going to be the first of this new style of product, is the HP Elite X3, which looks like an awesome device, but they're going 3-in-1. So you're going to start to see Windows Mobile devices that are basically large phones. So you can kind of say they're like phablets. So it's kind of like you could almost say 4-in-1, right? It's kind of like a tablet, not a full tablet, but it's a phablet. And you throw it in a dock, and then using the feature called Continuum, the phone will present on a monitor a desktop-like interface that allows you to run the applications on the phone while the phone kind of does its own thing over here. The phone's doing everything, but it's you can, you know, answer calls, you can, you know, send text messages, you can kind of interact with the phone as the phone, but then interact with the second screen as a desktop-like experience. where HP is really running with this, and Continuum debuted on the 950 and the 950 XL with the Microsoft dock, but it hasn't really kind of gone anywhere. Very few programs were kind of leveraging it. HP is shooting all business for this, and they're basically saying, hey, you know, you're going to dock this, and then we're going to make it very easy. We're going to support all of these x86, you know, Win32 big business applications that are being ran in the cloud, and so you dock your phone, and then cloud services will be handling running all of these big programs that you'll interact with, you know, kind of like in a remote desktop kind of feel. And actually, Windows Continuum, I mean, you can, there is a remote desktop application for Windows Mobile. You can put it in a dock, you can remote into a full PC and do that kind of stuff. But then, you know, Windows Mobile is just a thin client, and that's kind of not an ideal experience for this whole 3-in-1 model. The other three is that HP is also putting out a lap dock kind of, it's like a thin client notebook, which is not really a notebook, but you just kind of plug the phone into it, and then you have like a notebook PC, again, interacting with Continuum. So that's the play. And I don't know, Rich, what do you think about that future? Or Cecilia, for that matter. I mean, you've been around a long time in the PC world. How do you think that's going to go?
Which thing? You've said so many.
The three-in-one approach. I mean, 3-in-1 has been attempted in the past, but hasn't really gone anywhere. But this is the first time I would say there's a company like HP who, you know, Microsoft knows how to work with HP, and HP knows how to work with Microsoft and target devices for business.
I think it sounds like an awesome concept. I see this for somebody who travels a lot. I mean, if a certain someone we all know and love was really more of a technology enthusiast, I would say that this would make his job so much easier. It's really cool.
So here I think you make the really important point about this in that article, Matt. Right at the end, basically, you're talking about how you know, most people who use a 3-in-1 device, the X3 or whatever, are probably still going to want to have what you refer to as a second phone. And I think that's exactly right. I almost think you have to kind of look at this device in a different sort of way, not as a new kind of phone, but almost not as a smartphone replacement, but almost more like a notebook replacement. Mm-hmm. Like that's the competition. You know, the X3 isn't competing with the iPhone or the Samsung Galaxy, and most people who use an X3 will probably continue to have a device like that, you know, they either buy on their own for personal use or whatever, and so they'll still have a phone, but maybe they won't have a laptop. Maybe if you're, someone who travels a bunch and has computing requirements that are a good fit for a device of this size and so on, then, you know, you don't need to tote around a laptop anymore. You've got this X3, and it's light and compact, and you can put it in your pocket, and like Celia said, it's just really cool to have this be your primary work device, and it's good to go when you're on the road. You can plug it in and use it on a full-size monitor when you're back at your desk. So I can see a market for the 3-in-1, but I don't know that It potentially sort of opens, you know, a door for Windows Mobile to really sort of conquer the smartphone space. I think it becomes a, you know, business productivity device play that could have a future instead, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I don't think this is Microsoft saying we're going to compete in smartphones. I think they're saying this is a new business. This is a new model for a business device that if you're an enterprise, you're a big you're a company that might already at this point, deploy to a lot of users or every user a phone because you don't want to bring your own device for security reasons. So you don't like people bringing in their personal phones to put on. You're deploying a laptop and maybe a desktop. That's a lot of hardware to support. And if one device really can do it all, handle all of those business situations, it's a significant cost savings for that business, right? I mean, it's one license instead of three. You know, it's one device to manage instead of three. I mean, I'm sure you can kind of spiral out the cost savings all in there, and it's all managed and it's all secure. So that is the vision anyway. We'll just have to see how it goes, but that's Windows Mobile's last stand. So I also noticed a different article just today talking about Windows Mobile sales in the United States. You know, it's like all of these giant headlines like Windows Mobile sales plummet, fall off cliff, now, you know, 0.6% of the market. And it's like, well, sure, but nobody sells them anymore, right? So,
right.
They're dumping inventory of the 950 and 950 XL, I guess, probably stepping aside to make room for the, you know, like the Elite X3, which isn't going to be, if it's sold at retail, it'll be sold at the Microsoft store. Like, there's no, you can't just, like, walk into any carrier currently, other than, like, AT&T, and buy a modern Windows 10, Windows 10 mobile device. So, it's not shocking that sales have fallen off a cliff, because nobody sells them anymore. It'll be interesting to see where this goes. They got a lot in place. They got the universal Windows application model, where you can write one modern app and have it run across, you know, Xbox and desktop and laptop and phone. And I think that has already proven to bring some of the big players who used to have apps for Windows Phone, but stopped, like some of the big banks, I think Wells Fargo and Bank of America, who dropped support for their app a long time ago, is now back in because, you know, there's 350 million Windows 10 devices that can run that application. So doing it in the universal model makes it very simple to put it on the mobile device. It's not all that extra work. So who knows? Maybe this will go somewhere. Maybe this is the next big thing, right? One device for everything. Who knows? Cecilia, you want one device for everything?
That would be convenient.
It would kind of be convenient, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Throw
it in a little dock and...
Yeah, you don't have to worry about any kind of, you know, issues about, oh, that thing, I just downloaded it and left it on my desktop, on my laptop, oh, this. I just want one thing. And I want it to work really, really well.
Yeah. So, I don't know, you folks out there who might have liked Windows Mobile or Windows Phone back in the day, what do you think? You think the 3-in-1 vision is the right vision for Windows Mobile? Do you think it's going to have any traction? You planning on deploying it? Do you have customers that this would be good for? I don't know. Let us know. Hit us up on Facebook or on Twitter, at ChannelProSMB or Channel Pro Network on Facebook. And give us your thoughts. Tell us what you think. Because I'd love to see Windows Mobile continue to have a future. Perhaps maybe do a little catch up and start competing back in the smartphone space again. So who knows? So Rich, you've got an interview for us. I know you, and it was actually a good interview. I thought it was a really interesting topic. And one that needs a little bit more attention. So you talked to someone from ESET on the role of government deterrence in cybersecurity. So tell us a little bit, introduce that interview, and then we'll play that and we'll talk about that a little bit.
So this is why I love my job, is I get paid to go off and talk to people like Stephen Cobb. He is a senior security researcher at ESET, very, very knowledgeable, interesting about security. We spent about a half an hour at CompTIA ChannelCon a few weeks back talking about this and that. And we were talking, not surprisingly, about ransomware for a while during that conversation. It's obviously the hot topic in security right now. And at one point, he said to me, pretty much in passing, that we're going to continue seeing threats like ransomware arise until, and I'm more or less quoting here, the government listens to Stephen and does more about cybercrime deterrence. And then he kind of kept going, and later on in the conversation, I circled back and asked him about that.
So I'm curious, you said before, if the world was doing what Stephen thinks it should be doing, there would be more government deterrence. So yeah. what in particular did you have in mind?
So, interestingly, over in the UK, their annual crime statistics, and crime statistics are almost the defining function of a civilized society, right? You know, it started out in France in the 1800s, UK, England started doing it. Keeping track of how much crime there is one of the central functions of government. And governments haven't been doing a very good job of that. Particularly, I would say, in the United States, but in the UK, they finally included cyber in their general crime statistics, and it was like a large chunk. And so now you've got the police forces in the UK calling for the government to do more education and so on and so forth. But what I think is important is the deterrence factor, and you know, we see from time to time criminal hackers arrested. And that's good. But there's just not enough of that happening. And it's happening too slowly. So in criminology, studies for traditional crime have shown that the most bang for the buck in deterrence is swift justice. It's not the question of sentence. That the sentence is almost irrelevant. It's catching people quickly, which deters people. Because if you ask your average burglar, does it make a difference if burglary is a 5-year offense or a 10-year offense? They're like, no, because I'm not going to get caught. You wouldn't do it if you thought you were going to get caught, right? So I think we've just not applied the experience of what you might call meat space crime to cyberspace. And I know cybercrime investigation is very, very difficult, but we should be using a lot more resources than we have. I mean, I know people in the FBI. The FBI, I would not criticize in terms of its capabilities. It's really come a long, long way and has some really brilliant people. There's just not enough of them. And when I ask them about it, of course, your typical FBI agent is very diplomatic, right? But for them, it's a question of resource, not of resources, but of priority, right? So the agency has its priorities. And unfortunately, you know, cybercrime was building up late 1990s, but really got going in the early 2000s, at which point we were distracted with terrorism, right? As terrorism sort of faded out, we could get under cybercrime, but then we had the, you know, financial fraud. And that became, like, terrorism's been number one since 2001. But, you know, the fraud around 2008 that sort of came to be number two. And so cybercrime keeps getting up close to number two, but it you know, it's not quite there yet. And if you think of the budget of the FBI, it's really small compared to a lot of other agencies, even compared to the TSA. I mean, relative to what I think its importance is. And yeah, I don't think that we've taken it as seriously as we should. And a lot of times, What you hear on the street is this unvirtuous circle where businesses or people who are victims say, well, you ask them, did you report it, right, to the authorities? They say, no. Well, we tried that once, and they're not interested. We told them about it, but they said they couldn't do anything. So then people don't report it to the authorities. Well, the problem there is that most law enforcement is based on demand. You know, it's based on numbers. And if they don't have well, we, you know, do we have any cybercrime? No, not many reports. They don't get their money for that. So the Deputy Attorney General for Cyber, whose name escapes me at the moment, but I can get it to you, has been going around the country encouraging companies to report cybercrime because, you know, and breaches and incidents for two reasons. One being that builds the case for more money going into this. If they can say, look, you know, we're getting all these reports of all these problems and get more resources, but also because they see the big picture, right? So you're a sheet metal fabrication plant and you get some sort of attack and you're like, well, you know, I call the police and they're not that interested, and they say, you know, unless it's X amount of money, you can't do anything. But we had these hackers in the system and it was a problem. Well, you know, if the FBI gets that report, they may see a pattern with other things happening. You know, so they want to know what's going on, and you know, on the they will say themselves, look, we probably can't do anything about your specific case at this point in time, but it helps them build the picture. And then, you know, through organizations like InfraGuard, they can report back, you know, if a certain kind of real estate property company is getting targeted by a certain kind of a scammer, well, that feeds back through InfraGuard and the ISACs and so on. So, you know, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, information sharing is what we need to fight cybercrime. I think that's true, but it's not. There's a lot going on already. And you know, until we get more resources in responding, it's going to be hard to break that sort of cycle.
All right, so that was Stephen Cobb of ESET. I'm going to ask you kind of what you took away from this. It was a really interesting conversation. I agree, but I don't agree with this. And I'll tell you why, but why don't you kind of, for those who maybe aren't 100% sure what some of the stuff that he was talking about, Rich, why don't you kind of give a quick impression, and then we'll go into that.
Well, you know, I mean, typically when you're talking about security, when you're talking about ransomware within security, the conversation is mostly going to be about, you know, two things: the technology you use to keep the bad guys away, and user education, because it's very important, obviously, that people understand the threats, that the best antivirus software is powerless if people are doing really stupid things. But what I found really interesting about this conversation is just that he discusses security in a totally different context, and the context of crime. It's cyber crime, basically. And so what is it that deters criminals from committing certain kinds of what's that word he uses at one point? Meat space.
I don't think I've ever heard that word before.
Me neither. But yeah. Basically, whatever it is that you do to deter people from committing crimes in the physical, non-technology world, to some extent, you're going to have to do in this world of cybercrime, or it's just going to keep happening, essentially. And obviously, his point is just, you know, it's way too easy to get away with this stuff right now. And so until we start applying more resource to this issue and, you know, beginning to teach the hackers that crime doesn't pay, cybercrime doesn't pay, it's just going to continue being this plague that all of us are dealing with. And, you know, this is a guy from a security technology company kind of telling you, we're going to do everything we can to protect people, but we can't make this problem go away with, you know, even the best security technology. There's got to be more going on than that.
So I agree with all the parts about not getting caught, about how when he was talking about, like, you know, it doesn't matter if the punishment is 5 years or 10 years, because they don't really care about the punishment side of it, because they just don't think they're going to get caught. And here's and then saying government reliance, or, you know, government is what's going to end up solving this problem. I just don't see that working, because the problem with cybercrime, especially with things like hacking, is that everything becomes an international investigation right off the bat. This is not like the robber who is burglarizing a house, who has physical goods in his hand and is basically residing in an area where he can be investigated and arrested. everything within one department, right? Like, as soon as you start crossing state line and international lines, it becomes this giant bureaucratic nightmare to do law enforcement. So that's where I'm gonna say I don't agree with the whole government deterrence part. I do think those who get caught should be severely punished.
But the problem is that it takes a really long time to catch them. However, I think maybe a missing piece in the conversation is that even though Stephen Cobb says that, you know, this is a major role for government, and it is, but it's a major coordination effort on the part of government. There are so many mainstream security companies like ESET, like Trend Micro, like Kaspersky. They have people tracking down all of these, you know, new strains of ransomware and where they're coming from and, you know, fascinating stuff. It's like, I wish that we could cover more of that, because the sleuthing on the part of, you know, channel companies is amazing, and what they're able to learn and the people they have working there. And all of these companies work with the federal government to help them, you know, track some of this stuff down and prosecute these criminals. But the point that Stephen makes is about resources, and that is part of it, is that this country has not had enough of, you know, yeah, there are the major headlines and whatnot about cyber criminals and whatever, but it really doesn't affect a lot of, like, regular people. When this starts becoming so rampant that it can no longer be ignored, we will have to put more resources to it.
And, you know, I should say it's interesting that you say that, because that's kind of a point, or related to a point, that Stephen made early on in the conversation when we were discussing ransomware. Is he said that, you know, it's this terrible thing that's impacting enormous numbers of people, and there's nothing good about it except that it has really raised awareness of IT security in general, awareness of and concern about. And so if there's anything positive that's come out of ransomware, he was saying basically, it's that people are starting to get more concerned. They're starting to sort of mobilize a little bit about IT security now, because it is affecting ordinary people on a much more widespread basis.
Mm-hmm.
I think government's role in that, I think it's the private sector and security companies that are going to take the lion role in this, in terms of the identification. And government's role will be to more
prosecution,
but also to more rapidly apprehend, right? So if these security companies can identify the source of a hacking, and this is an international effort, right? I mean, like, because the hacker that they're investigating is going to be on some remote area in Russia. I mean, the government's role in this is all governments has to say, when we need to be able to identify these threats, where they are originating from quickly, and then have guys out, you know, rapid fire reporting and resources available to go and apprehend in an immediate fashion. But I don't know what else the government can do to deter, other than make punishment severe, like super severe, and invest resources into being able to more quickly go after guys once they're identified.
Well, I mean, I think Stephen would basically say that the scenario you just described is what government can and should do from a deterrence standpoint. And you're right, it's very much has to be an international kind of effort. But the idea that you're responding rapidly and visibly, from a prosecution kind of standpoint, that is the government deterrence that's kind of missing right now.
Yeah, as long as the reporting happens from the private sector once once it's identified. Like, the last thing you want is some police department in Fresno having to then work with the FBI, which then it's those bureaucratic layers of investigation that end up really making this a problem. You know, you got to be able to go right to the local law enforcement force of wherever the origination is and have those reportings done there. But then the prosecution is also crazy too, because if they're committing a crime against a company in the United States or whatever in a different country, who knows? But I guess, like, once they're apprehended, even if that part takes a long time, I mean, they're caught, they're not doing it anymore, they're not free. I guess that's kind of a good thing. So I don't know. Crazy interview. Really cool to think about. Very complicated. It's gonna make my head explode. I don't know. Anything else you want to say on that, Rich?
No, I think that was a very interesting point on Stephen's side of things, and interesting chat on our part.
All right. So, speaking of making heads explode, we have some awesome end of the show stuff coming up right after this break. So we're gonna check in on Mr. Joel, and I've got museum and hardware, or museum and tech pick for you guys. And Rich is going to give us the look back and the look ahead in his in case you missed it in What's Up This Week previews. So stick around for that. We will be right back. All right, and we're back. So as people know, we follow around Mr. Joel, our associate publisher, because he travels a lot for Channel Pro, and he's always at all these crazy events, and he's like a ninja. You never know when he's going to appear and where he's going to appear and whether or not he's going to hit you over the head with a sword or buy you a drink. Normally it's the latter, but I wouldn't put him past him on the first one. So this week... So we've got 2 weeks of Joel to catch up with, so, and I'm sure he's been all over the place. So, Rich, why don't we just start right now? Where is Joel?
Well, I am nearly certain that right now Joel is in East Brunswick, New Jersey.
Ooh,
that's where we all go for. No, you're right. You're right.
And recreation.
He is in New Jersey this week. So,
and specifically for an ASCII event. Taking place in East Brunswick yesterday and today.
Cool.
Yes, and do you? I mean, he's actually bounced around quite a bit the last like week and a half. I think he was in DC because mm-hmm. I know he's checking in on our space for our next event, and then he was somewhere before that too. Do you happen to remember where that was?
Well, that was when I was swilling wine, so I don't know where he was last week. Earlier this week, he was in D.C. because there was that Channel Partners conference there. And so he was there to attend the conference, I believe. We even had a booth there. I'm not certain about that, but I think we did. And then, while he was in D.C., he was kind of checking up on the venue for our event that we were talking about before. I'm not sure where he was last week, though.
Wasn't he in Huntsville?
Oh,
he was. Yeah, he was.
It was at Abtran.
Yeah.
There you go. Alabama to D.C. This is why we love to keep an eye on Mr. Joel, because in like 2 weeks' time, he's been from Florida to Alabama to D.C. and now New Jersey. And who knows where he'll be next week. You just have to tune in and listen.
To find out.
All right, I have a museum pick for my little stash of large stash of gear. So, for my next issue, I have lots of issues. That's not what I meant. I meant for the next issue, I put together a piece that I just finally submitted, kind of very last minute, to Miss Cecilia, and she came back to me on a line that I had in there, and she said, "You mean the opposite of this, right?" So I'm not going to spoil the article for anybody. Maybe we'll talk about it next week. But what I was talking about was stylus-driven input in PC computing, right? And I basically said, you know, Microsoft's been keen on stylus interface, in digitizers and inking for a very long time. And that kind of, like, shocked Cecilia. Is that true?
It is.
So I said, like they've been pushing this stylus stuff really since the it really kind of started in the very late 90s, and then their first iterations in inking happened in the mobile world with Pocket PC, and then in 2001 they showed off Windows. Oh God, what was it? The Windows Pen interface or something like that. But basically, it kind of debuted with the first tablet PC computers. Believe it or not, the first tablet PC computers came out a very long time ago. With those kind of started to hit around 2002. So the oldest tablet PC computer that I have is the IBM ThinkPad X41, which came out around 2005. It's got a stylus and a digitizer in it, but it's not like a touchscreen. Like, if you touch the screen, all you do is you put fingerprints on it. It doesn't do anything. It only interacts with the pen that it comes with. And then other than that, it's just a regular Windows XP computer, but it was the tablet edition of that computer. So I thought that would be kind of cool to talk about in this. So you never saw tablet PCs way, way back in the day?
I don't remember seeing tablet PCs back in the day.
Yeah, Microsoft has this knack of like getting into markets and pushing awesome ideas before the technology is really there to make it user-friendly. That's happened in tablets, like, and it's happened in phones, and it's happened in all kinds of stuff. So, Rich, did you ever have one of those old tablet PCs?
Well, I have an interesting little angle on this. So I know would be the short answer to that question. But I, as longtime listeners know, I used to work at Microsoft, and I was actually there when the first tablet edition of Windows shipped around that 2002 time frame. And I remember devices like this one showing up on the Microsoft campus. And, you know, if you had one of those and brought one to a conference room, you were like the coolest guy in the room. Everybody just was gaga over these things. And so I very much remember most people don't know, let alone remember, which is that Microsoft really kind of, you know, created the tablet space in a certain way. And then, you know, kind of like you were saying, somebody else, Apple in this case, kind of stepped in and took it to a whole different level. This whole kind of product line and approach just sort of fizzled out.
Capacitive touch didn't really exist back in the day, so there was no really good finger friendly way of doing touch at the time. A lot of these early tablet PCs didn't even have a capacitive touch layer either. A resistive touch layer. My apologies to the tech guys out there. There wasn't even a resistive layer on there, so you couldn't use your finger at all. Like, it only interacted with the stylus and the digitizer. They've been big in this for a long time. Bill Gates has always loved the idea of inking on a computer, handwriting recognition and pen-driven interface. So.
And isn't it interesting the way this has sort of circled around and around? So Microsoft comes out with a stylus-driven tablet. Apple introduces the iPad and just scoffs, ridicules the whole idea of using a stylus with a tablet at all. And then just within the last year or year and a half, whatever, thanks to the introduction and early success of the Surface, which has a stylus, lo and behold, Apple is now shipping the iPad Pro, which is, you know, very much a touch-driven device, but it also, for the first time, has a stylus. Maybe that wasn't such a silly idea in the first place.
No, Rich. The iPad Pro has a pencil.
Oh, okay. I stand corrected.
So it's cool now. But, you know, but it's okay. Apple invented the stylus. It's fine. So... So anyway, so the IBM ThinkPad X41 is my museum pick, and it's a IBM ThinkPad. So if you think about Lenovo, and I actually kind of compared it against the Lenovo Twist at the time because it has like one of those Twist rotating displays, and that actually it was like an early 2-in-1, right? You know, like 2-in-1s mm-hmm. back in 2002. You know, that rotating display kind of hasn't really been the 2-in-1 concept that has really taken off. The foldover design really has kind of become the two-in-one standard. But HP does still make a twistable two-in-one computer called the EliteBook Revolve 810. So that's going to be my tech pick this week. So if you're still interested in a two-in-one that kind of has like that screen that kind of like pivots on that one central point, which is really handy if you just have to flip the screen around because you don't have to like flip around the entire notebook. If you do like a lot of like little presentations on a desk and you need to flip things around, it's really handy for that. That's my tech pick this week is the HP EliteBook Revolve 810 G3. It is a really nice looking 2-in-1, a Windows 10 Pro 64, up to a Core i7-5600U, Intel HD graphics, 8 gigs or more of RAM, nice display, very portable, good look, bends and twists and does all kinds of stuff. So HP still makes one just like that one, and you can go and pick one up for yourself today. So that's my tech pick, is the EliteBook Revolve 810. Rich, give us the what was and the what is.
Well, let's start with the what was. On Friday, in my next In Case You Missed It piece, which recaps the week that was and the news that we didn't get a chance to go into, I will be talking about something that we haven't really written about on the website, haven't talked about in this podcast, which is the Intel Developer Forum that was going on this week. So I've got a bunch of news from there. Because I'm a mensch, I'm a pal, I like to make my buddy Matt happy, I may just include a few headlines out of the GamesCon conference that took place in Europe this week. Some familiar and less familiar names made news there in the games world. And then we'll talk just a little bit about some really interesting evidence from researchers at Checkpoint this week that shows ransomware hackers are just like us, basically. You'll have to read to get into the details if you haven't seen this before, but it turns out there's a ransomware channel out there. And
oh, boy.
Yeah, very interesting news from Checkpoint. Then Monday, every Monday morning, first thing in my What's Up This Week piece, which kind of sets out the agenda for the week ahead, we will preview what's going to be a relatively slow kind of vacation season week, but there are going to be some interesting security-related conferences going on. We're going to get earnings reports from HP Inc., who we were just talking about, and Tech Data. And then next week is the 133rd anniversary of the Krakatoa volcano, which had me thinking a little bit. It is alleged to have been the loudest sound ever heard on Earth, and so I thought maybe we would just explore that concept a little bit. Was it really the loudest sound on Earth? And what is the loudest sound on Earth that you could hear today?
Probably me whining about Windows phones. That would be the loudest sound you could hear today.
You're waiting for one of us to say no, no, no.
No, I figured you guys would agree with that. All right. You can subscribe to Channel Pro Weekly, so that way you can have it delivered right to your phone or other podcast app. So if you're in the Apple world, you can subscribe on iTunes. Just go to iTunes Podcast and search Channel Pro Weekly, and you'll find us there. Leave us a good rating. Tell the world that you love us, even though we're not always on time every week with each episode. We don't have to mention that. We could just mention the good stuff. If you are not in the Apple world, it's channelpronetwork.com/RSS/CPW. That is how you can subscribe through that in any podcast application, and they will start coming down to you as fast as our servers can spit those files out to you. You can also follow me on Twitter, @MattWhitlock. You can follow Rich at
@RichFree.
And Miss Cecilia at?
At Ceil Gal, CEILGAL.
And, of course, the Channel Pro, you follow Channel Pro as well, at Channel Pro SMB on Twitter, and we're also on Facebook, so facebook.com/Channel Pro Network. Like our page there and kind of interact with us there. That's where we like to hang out. So with that, if you have comments, questions, emails, can be sent to us at podcast@channelpronetwork.com. And we'd love to get your mail and read it on the air. So please send us some emails, and we'll read those and share them with the world there, as good or bad. So, you know, we don't discriminate. We'll tell it like it is. So with that being said, thanks for tuning in to episode 22, and we will see you all next week.